Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Conscious Thought with Leo on PBS Radio Talk Show, and I am your host, Magdalena Winkler. Well, tonight we are a little late. We had a little Skype issue because we are dealing today with the all around the globe in on the south hemisphere, and we are landing today with our journey, and our guest is actually in Australia. Well, good morning. Actually, Bradley, for you is morning, even though for us is evening here. And welcome to the show.
That's correct. Thank you, Magdalena. glad to be with you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Listen, how is it over there in beautiful Australia?
Well, I'd like to say that we're in the middle of winter, and actually we're having quite a cold spell. So I'm in Sydney, but yeah, the weather is not that terrific, actually.
Oh my God. Oh wow. I was actually in Sydney 1983, so I absolutely love it. I was there for 10 weeks.
Right. Yes. Well, we don't have too much of a winter, but this year it's been we have had quite a cold spell.
Oh wow. Well, anyway, Bradley, I have to tell you, I'm so excited, you know, to have you tonight on the show, because you are bringing this amazing challenge. I am so fascinated when I found you, bio on actually your submission to the BBS radio show. I said, oh my God, I have to have this person on my show.
Oh, so, great. Thank you.
You are welcome. Well, I just wanted to introduce you shortly for our listeners. Oh, before we start actually with the introduction and everything else, I wanted to let our listeners know they can actually call in if they have a question. And the telephone number would be 888-627-6008. Okay, this is our little short bio about Bradley. As we know, he is actually from Australia. And originally, you were Bradley actually trained as a lawyer, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes. That was my day job.
That was your day job. I was actually listening yesterday on one of the videos, and I had to kind of enjoy it because you were in the beginning, maybe 30 years ago, you started to write. And what was very fascinating to me that you were actually reading the work of Sigmund Freud, and you were so fascinated with his work that you actually read his whole work twice, which is almost 3 million words.
That's right. Yes. I became Freud's greatest fan, I think.
Yes, and what is also fascinating to me, that as you were researching, or actually when you were reading, you found out that actually Freud, unconscious mind, and Hindu inner self were one of the same. And from there on, you devoted your life tracking the inner self. That is amazing to me.
Yes, well, that's pretty much the how it really happened for me.
Yes, and you know what is amazing also, you being a lawyer, and now you are actually, you know, this is so much, you know, the left brain, and then you went in this, I'm calling it, didn't look like in this right brain, where you're actually blending spirituality, science, philosophy, and history, and piloting us into this whole new evolutionary age. So...
Oh, yeah.
So
you reckon it's my right brain that's doing all
yes,
this
I
now?
Did.
Okay,
yes,
I've
did.
Gone from left to right. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, we are being the lawyer. That's a totally left brain.
Right, sure.
You know, so my question, my first question to you would be actually, how did you connect all these dots?
Oh, okay. Well, as you've just explained from the what you just said, it wasn't really a question of connecting dots per se. It just one thing seemed to lead seamlessly into the next. I really started out as I was a lawyer, and it was really an impulse to write. More than anything
exactly.
else that really
mm-hmm.
started me on all this, because I was working as a lawyer, but I was trying to write novels and plays and all sorts of things, and I was writing a crazy journal about my own life, and it was just this urge to write which really started me off. And then I was trying to write a novel that had a hero that had to know about psychology. So this is like at the age of 35, I knew nothing about psychology, and I thought, well, how do I find out something about all this? And the name Sigmund Freud sort of popped up as being, you know, obviously someone that I'd heard about that in the psychological field. So I just went to the library and started to read his works, and it was a huge magnus of works, like 23 volumes, and I just started at volume one and started working my way through. And I just he's a brilliant writer, of course, as well as his theories, and it was just, I was just totally hooked. And then from then on, so once I'd really got into the psychoanalytical way of thinking, and then a girlfriend I had at the time introduced me then to Hinduism. She was going to this ashram here in Sydney that they did chanting, Hindu chanting, and so she introduced me to that. So that I got into the Hinduism side of it as well, you know, it just became abundantly clear to me then that what Freud was talking about with his with the unconscious mind was pretty much the same or similar concept to what the Hindus were saying about the inner self. And so then from Freud, I really started to get involved in Hinduism, and I went to India, and purchased a large number of sacred books to actually really learn about Hinduism and the theory behind it. And so I studied all those books. Then I came back to Australia, and I actually started writing articles about Hinduism interpreted from more a scientific point of view, from a point of view of Freudian psychoanalysis, but then also, the actual structure of the brain. Where could this inner self actually be located in the brain? So I went then, and so I started to actually study neuroscience then. With a view to actually locating then the inner self in the brain. And I came up with these, there was all this material, and it just sort of fell in place, of all this material in conventional neuroscience about that the driving forces in the brain all seem to be coming from the what I call the embryo brain region. It's the brain stem.
That is what was so fascinating when I was watching the video yesterday. Oh my God, that was amazing. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, this is the part of the brain that actually, in conventional science, it's considered the bird brain sort of thing, that the ancient brain or the, but in point of fact, it consists of the brainstem, midbrain, hypothalamus, and thalamus, and this is the essential brain that first develops in the embryo, and then the human regions, the so-called higher regions, they all grow out of that. But I developed all these theories then about how it was actually that core embryo brain, which is actually where the inner self is located, and then that's setting up the higher regions, the cerebral cortex, and all the information that is actually going from bottom to top. And what we become conscious of on the cerebral cortex is actually caused by initiated by impulses deep in the regions, in the lower regions of the brain. So, and also in addition to that, it seemed to me that, you know, every creature, not just human beings, but every creature then has this core embryo brain that that they start out with. And then, so if there is an inner self in all creatures, which is this, what the Hindus say about the thing, then as a matter of logic, it must be in this core embryo brain region. So that was my starting point as a matter of logic of where this was all was located.
Let me ask you, Bradley, a question to that. Do you think that also, I mean, you're studying Hinduism and also, you know, is this also maybe also connected to the chakras?
Well, I actually came up with an entirely the chakras concept, where the chakra, you know, the base chakra down in the pelvic region, the spinal base of the spine, and then going up the back backbone up through to the top of the head, where the head chakra is in the top of the head at the cerebral cortex.
Mm-hmm.
No, I virtually rejected that entire line of thinking. At another level in terms of our body schema or whatnot, the chakras evidently do exist, but in terms of the essential location of the inner self, I put it squarely in this embryo brain region, brainstem, midbrain, thalamus and hypothalamus.
The reason why I'm asking it, because they are also saying that the chakra system is also connected to the brain circuits. So that's why I was just kind of asking.
Yes. And so the short answer to that is, according to my theories, the chakra system is then set up from the base of the brain in the embryo brain region as well as. The connection with the chakras would be just along those lines, that still it's the essential inner self is located in the embryo brain region. And then when the brain develops and the body develops and everything else, well, then these chakras, then they derive their life force, if you like, or their force field from then the embryo brain region. That would be the way on that. This theory, which essentially is a new interpretation of Hinduism, it was published in major journals in India, philosophical journals, including the Indian Philosophical Quarterly. So at that stage, when I was on this journey, I actually became an accredited Hindu philosopher. The Indian Philosophical Quarterly is the premier academic philosophical journal in India, published by the University of Pune. And so, I mean, it's only their top line academics, their top line thinkers in India, that actually get published in that particular journal. And I just sort of came to it completely from a, you know, completely different route altogether, and put all these theories together without any formal training. And so, you know, I'm saying that somehow I got some inspiration that I was being driven to come up with this theory, and it wasn't just I'd studied it in school and this is what I thought. There was something pushing me along to actually put this theory out there, and to the point where, you know, I wrote this article and I sent it to this Indian Philosophical Quarterly, But it wasn't even in the right format for them. You know, they've got their own you know, specific formats for the material they publish, obviously. And so they actually accepted this article from someone in the other side of the world, not even in the right format, but they apparently read it through and could see that you know, the article had merit.
You did your homework.
Yes, exactly. That I'd done my homework, and mm-hmm. they reformatted it for me and published it. So I mean, it actually put me up there with all these other philosophers and thinkers in India that have spent a lifetime actually studying in order to be able to get their work published in this particular journal. It sort of put me right in their club, right from the word go.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Well, it is, but you know, that was only then. Really, that was only just the start of my journey, because at that point, then I had all this inspiration, and I'd put all this material together about the location of the inner self. And also all the other theory then that comes with Hinduism about the world, the external world that we see out there is actually an illusion, that you know, a virtual reality is how it would be described these days. So my theories then went that. Yes, the world is an illusion, just like the Hindus were saying, and it seemed to me then, from my theories about the inner self, that it was actually then somehow we were all connected at the base of the brain, all creatures, not just humans, but all of us in this embryo brain region. There's some sort of connection beneath the physical world, where we're all connected, and it's somehow this network that is then setting up the world that we see.
Are we talking about substratum?
Yes, yes.
Oh, exactly. Listen, I have to tell you, Bradley, I am not a science. I had a hard time to understand that word. Do you mind to explain this to us, to people who are not understanding it?
Well, okay. So just the notion then of a substratum, for starters, then in relation to actually the structure of our brain, I'm saying that this embryo brain region actually constitutes a substratum of the brain. It's beneath. It's we're not conscious of what's going on there. We've got no conscious control over it. But it's the substratum which sets up then the higher regions of the brain, and it's from the substratum then that the information comes that then we ultimately perceive the physical world via the senses. That this is just a sense data that actually comes from the substratum, and then in relation then to the physical world. In quantum physics as well, there is a lot of theory about, you know, the substratum beneath the physical world. Dirac, one of the main initiators of quantum theory, his theory all depends on them actually being a substratum beneath the physical world, which actually sets up the physical world. And so... I was thinking along the lines that, okay, this substratum in the brain is somehow, this manages to generate a physical world, and then that becomes then the substratum of the physical world. But still, I saw it that this was some sort of connection that not perceived by any of the five senses, some sort of a network or connection that was actually setting up the world. But that was all I had at that stage. And then it wasn't until quite a few years later that I came across a theory by some German writers, Fossart and Bludorf, about the networked intelligence in the DNA. And Just a friend of mine told me about this, that he'd seen something about this on the internet. It was a book that wasn't even published in English. It was just a book in German, but people were talking about it on the internet. And as soon as I read anything, something about this theory, I thought, yes, that to me that was it. I mean, the connection that the substratum is literally our DNA. It's in the genome. It's the nucleus of the cell. This idea that we're all connected at that level. Is what really struck a chord with me, because then that then can logically, that's a situation then where it explains the substratum in the brain, it explains the substratum in the physical world, and then this notion then that we're all, it's in our DNA that's networked at the subquantum level, that's when my theories then started to really become concrete, so I had to order that book from Germany. I fortunately had done a schoolboy German, so. But I was very rusty at it. But I had to order that book, and I read it from cover to cover with the aid of an English-German dictionary, and translated it. And there's several chapters in my book about then this networked intelligence in the DNA as a straight translation of what they were saying. And then I went back to university myself. Then I thought, right, their theories about this networked intelligence in the DNA were very vague. Actually, they had no specific or very little scientific material to back up their claims. And so I went back to university.
What year was it, Bradley? What year was it?
2004. Their book came out.
Okay. It's not that long ago. Mm-hmm.
No, not that long ago. I see that 2004. I came across that, and that was a pivotal change for me in where my theories were heading. Mm-hmm. But I started writing in the mid 80s. So.
You started the book 30 years ago.
Years ago, and it was only not. It was not. So, you know, it was not that I started writing a book, and I already knew how it was going to end. It seemed to be a case of, you know, at different stages in my life, then new theories, new parts came along, which prompted then new chapters for the book. Once I'd got in, then this notion then of the networked intelligence in the DNA, that sort of completed the picture in terms of, you know, I'd started out with Freud's unconscious mind, and then went into the Hindu inner self, and now this was now an area where this would virtually explain everything. It was just now a question of actually locating the scientific data then for this networked intelligence in the DNA, and then I felt that I would have a complete theory to present. That's how my book has actually evolved.
So practically, you were actually building layer upon layers.
Yes, that's exactly the way it was mm-hmm. For me. You know, and sometimes, like those articles that I published in India, that was in the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a hiatus then for a good 10 years where I was kind of, you know, sort of thinking around it. And before that book, The Networked Intelligence and the DNA, came out in 2004, which then set me on a whole that virtually set me on a whole new direction. Back to university, studying physics, studying genetics, And so, I mean, that took then, you know, that that took three or four years.
Well, so practically you were guided somehow.
Exactly. That's exactly. Throughout this whole thing, I was actually guided, and the end result of the book is it never ceases to amaze me, because throughout all that, the book that finally emerges, it's a complete book. It looks like it's got, you know, structure but it wasn't me planning it. It wasn't, you know, there was sidetracks. I was sidetracked through those
that
years.
That was a writing from you, intelligence from your DNA.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The book proves the theory, because it was coming from the theory was coming from the substratum.
Exactly. Exactly right. I'm telling you, I was challenged by this fourth substratum.
Yes, for sure. That's right.
You know, Bradley, I mean, what is fascinating for me, I mean, we are actually right now in this incredible challenging era. There is so much turmoil. We have so much information, and nobody knows actually really the truth, what's really going on. And so I would say, I'm just reading here that, you know, your work is actually timely in response to question being raised by scientific community and others. You know, the question, one of them would be, are we living in the computer simulation? Does the matrix really exist? So practically, you know, your spiritual genome is a cohesive blend of science, spirituality, what we were talking about before, with Hinduism and it, you know, roots, shedding light to the network intelligence in the DNA. And so you are saying,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so practically you are saying that the DNA can act as a universal quantum computer. So through this body of work, the matrix unfold, and I would add down the rabbit hole.
That right, for sure. Well, this is true. With quantum computing now, mainstream scientists are starting to realize that the potential of quantum computers is such that, in fact, the universe really could be a simulation. The mainstream scientists are actually saying that they can foresee a future point where they themselves will have sufficient technology to be able to simulate another universe. There's a serious amount of material out there now, which I've summarized. I've done a chapter about it all in my book, where mainstream scientists are seriously theorizing that either this universe that we are currently in could be a simulation, or that it's only a matter of time before our descendants will be able to simulate a universe which they're saying will be so perfect that you won't be able to tell it from the real thing.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, this is pretty scary. Don't you
think?
Well,
it is. Well, I think it is scary. It's scary for anyone that is going to hold on to their preconceived notions that there's a real physical world out there, but there are a lot of people that have those, you know, rock solid convictions that, oh, you know, this the world can't be virtual, the world can't be mental, you know, it all looks so solid. And but in conventional quantum physics these days, more and more, every article I pick up now, they're all saying crisis in quantum physics. You know, that in order to make their theories work, they're now postulating that not 80% of something of the world must be, of the universe must be composed of dark matter, otherwise their theories about gravity are wrong, and that another 20% of the world must be composed of dark energy, because otherwise the theories can't explain why the universe is expanding. Every second article I read is virtually, yes, physics is in a state of crisis.
That's what I'm saying, exactly.
That's right. So it's only in a state of crisis in as much as more and more the physical theories are telling them that the world out there can't actually be physical. More and more, but so all that's still required is virtually just a change of mindset. Instead of what you've got essentially, most physicists would agree that they are now talking about the entire universe acting as a quantum computer. That all this quantum theory actually involves particles. Moving or particles reacting in such ways that involve an assessment of probabilities. That it's not that the actual particles are doing this, but from a point of view of the mathematics, this is the probability that a particle is traveling at this speed. This is the probability that a particle is in such and such a position. So more and more the scientific community are realizing that that the universe is actually acting, the physical universe they see out there is actually acting as if it was a quantum computer, that it's just processing information, that the particles aren't really there, it's just information about the particles being processed, which is how they're actually explaining the physical world. And so, I mean, it's really not such a far cry from that then to say, well, wait a minute, maybe it's not that the universe itself is a quantum computer. Maybe there is a quantum computer somewhere that is literally generating the universe
and playing us.
Sorry.
And playing us.
Exactly. Exactly.
The reason why, Bradley, because I was actually trying to ask you a question right now, then yes. If this is actually a quantum computer, then where is the free will of the individual?
Well, the short answer to that, as far as I can see, is there is no free will of the individual. From my own experiences, my own theories, the entire world has been the entire world has been generated by a quantum computer in our DNA, which is setting up the entire world. And so, I mean, there is a grand plan there. We're all part of this grand plan, I really can't see how in the grand scheme of things, how any individual gets to say, you know, well, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. It's like with my book itself. It all seems to have been laid out by in the substratum, and I had absolutely no say in on where what I was doing or where I was going. You know.
So you've been told, you just followed what you've been told.
Yeah, I just go with the flow, man. That's the way it's been for me. And I am a total fatalist. I believe that it's all preordained, and that the world is actually evolving the way it's supposed to be, according to this preordained plan, and that the things that actually happen as a result of quantum computing assessing the probabilities, and the most probable thing that comes up as a matter of mathematics is what actually happens. And
so then let me ask you another question. Then how can we believe that everything is an illusion?
Well, because
this is right now challenging. You can see it.
Well, no, but I mean the data, the output from the in my book. Then I specifically deal with the DNA as a quantum computer. I give a lot of scientific evidence about memory in the DNA, memristors. This notion of memristors, which is a new form of memory that they're actually developing now with normal computer hardware. I've the structure of the brain, the DNA itself seems to me conducive for these, for the DNA to be composed of all these memristors, and that contain and process data. And so that, and then all the electrical activity that I detail, all the state-of-the-art scientific material about all the electrical activity in the, or electronic, I should say, activity in the brain, which all indicates to me that actual processing, storage, and processing of data is occurring in the DNA. And then I actually, in my theories then, the DNA absorbs and emits light, these biophotons. And I've in my book then, I have got state-of-the-art scientific material about how these biophotons being emitted from the DNA are then capable of triggering synapses in the neurons of the brain, which virtually the biophotons coming from the DNA then are capable of instigating neural network, literally turning neurons on and off, so that it's possible from processing in the DNA output from the DNA in terms of biophotons, which can then trigger all the five senses that we are capable of perceiving a real world, and then this all just is computer generated as images on the cortex of our own brain. So literally, it's a complete scientific explanation of what the Hindus have been saying all along, that the world literally is an illusion, and that that what we perceive as an external world, it just comes from data processing by the senses.
Well, you know what is so amazing to me, because you're also talking about the divided belief phenomena as a past life and reincarnation. So how we would connect on that?
Right. Well, no. Okay. Well, so now this this is the thing then about once I was able to come up with all this material about how the data can be stored in the DNA. Mm-hmm. Well, then it became clear to me that all living creatures then, not just humans, but all living creatures, then they live, that they're generated from the substratum. Then when they die, their life trajectory then is recorded as data in the DNA, and so the whole concept of the DNA evolving to me is a situation where every living creature, once they live and then they're born, they live, they die, all their entire life history is then recorded in the DNA as data. Once you've got this notion then of memory in the DNA, of data being stored in the DNA, well, then this then explains the notion of, you know, the general notion that we all have of soul, that the Christian notion,
well, essentially the Christian notion, but it goes back to the Greeks or something, I think. But this whole notion of that we have a soul, that our essence is somewhere preserved or living somewhere else or goes somewhere else when we die. Well, it does. This explains the whole notion of soul, but it's not as if our soul is living somewhere else, but essentially the fact that we've lived, our essence is recorded as data in the DNA. And so then this whole notion then of the DNA evolving, what this means is then that the DNA is evolving, in as much as new creatures are being generated, creatures die, new creatures are being generated, but the new people, the new things, creatures, living beings that come along, they have all evolved out of the creatures that have lived in the past, and so yes, it becomes a situation. I deal with this in the book. There's Rupert Sheldrake's notion of morphogenic resonance, the past, what occurred in the past is generating the future, and this kind of explains Rupert Sheldrake's notions then of morphogenic resonance, that the DNA is evolving based on memory of what's gone before.
That's so fascinating. I mean, yeah, I love also Rupert Sheldrake. Yes, definitely.
Good.
Yes, I was actually listening to him, watching him in Dr. Bruce Lipton. I don't know, do you know Dr. Bruce Lipton?
Yes, I do.
I was just watching the video maybe a month ago before I went to Germany. I just got back from Germany last week. So anyway.
Oh, okay.
Yes. You know, to me, this is fascinating because I love astrology and I strongly believe that we are actually reliving our ancestral energy. So what I may call ancestral energy, you are calling the memory in DNA.
Precisely. Exactly. And yes, you're obviously, tuned in and fully supportive of these notions.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the thing is with Rupert Sheldrake, his morphogenic resonance, he doesn't locate it in anywhere. He just talks about these morphogenic fields, that the presence of the past, but he's the only part of his theories that in my mind are hard to fathom is that it's so theoretical, and he gives no concrete explanation as to how all this could possibly occur. But
Bradley, do you know who else is actually using this morphogenic field? Is Barbara Hen? Barbara Hen?
Excuse me,
Claw.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. Go on. Barbara, say that again.
I said, do you know who else is using this morphogenic field? I like it. Is Barbara Hen Claw?
No, I haven't heard it. How do you spell that?
Barbara Hen/Claw.
Okay, I will have to look into that.
She is also very much, you know, work with Coleman, who was working right. with a Mayan calendar and stuff.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll have to look into that because, there are a lot of Bruce Lipton with his epigenetics, and there are a lot of people out there that are talking around this idea of information coming from the DNA, or from these morphogenic genetic fields and memory being stored there, but still. I can explain all their theories in terms of now this just a concrete theory about actually where it's located, where the memory is located, and how it's processed, and how it's actually then um, how it it can then the output from the processing can then actually go towards the evolution of new creatures, new living beings. So I mean, every writer obviously thinks that their theory is the best one, but I can actually give all their theories a much more concrete explanation as to how it actually can occur, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Bradley, we have maybe still 10 minutes left over. What I would like you to do is, do you mind to give our listener the information how they can actually access your book? And tell us more about your website and how they can contact you if you, you know, and find your information, please.
Certainly, that would be well. Okay. Well, at this stage, my book is can be purchased on Amazon.com or Nook, and my website is www.spiritualgenome.com. And yes, the book can be published. The book can be purchased via the website or in hard copy or ebook via Amazon.com or Nook.com. I mean, I don't know. My publisher actually has got that website up, and I don't think that my actual personal contact details are there, but if anyone does want to contact me, they can certainly write to my publisher, and she would pass that on to me, and I could respond in due course.
Mm-hmm. Is this possible to find you on the Facebook, on Twitter?
Oh yeah, okay. Yes, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter. Bartholomew at Spiritual Genome at Twitter, and also my Facebook page is Spiritual Genome as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any events you would like to promote or let our listener know? Because what I wanted to do is so that we have a few minutes left over, we can still continue the interview. But I just wanted to make sure that your information is out to the public.
Oh, that's thank you for that, Magdalena. Yes, I really don't have anything more specific to say in that regard.
Do you have any books for the future?
Well, no, not really. I've written several articles now that as new inspiration comes to me, I'm writing new articles. Obviously, I follow very closely what any new things that are coming out that might impact on my theories, mainly through a New Scientist magazine, which I devour New Scientist every week, really. And I'm writing a lot of new articles with further aspects of clarification with when new material comes out. So
where do you publish them so we can have access to that?
Well, that's all on my website, www.spiritualgenome.com, under articles. And yes, my articles are being very well received. I must say I'm getting lots of hits on these articles. I would recommend to anyone that's interested in my theories to first go and check out some of these articles, because there's so much new stuff coming out virtually every month of new aspects of this theory that all driving home the general theory that's actually set out in the book. So I mean, anyone that is motivated to look more further into my theories, they really should check out those articles, and they would find that from there, you know, they would probably be prompted to actually buy the book and see the complete theory.
I didn't have a chance to get the book, but I'm really looking forward to get your book and read more about, because it's totally fascinating for me.
Yes, well, that would be wonderful, Magdalene. As a matter of interest, you were just saying you've come back from Germany. So are you from Germany yourself, or where?
No, I was born in former Yugoslavia, mother language Hungarian. I lived in Germany and my family's in Germany.
Okay, so you would speak German very well then.
Yeah, I speak four different languages.
Oh, very good. Well, you've probably heard of Fozar and Bludorf yourself then, no doubt, have you?
Because no, I would actually love to send you an email so you can send me the book name up, you know. So that's what I would
do. Oh, right. Well, as a matter of fact, is your contact details there on your website?
Yes,
because I would be pleased to send that reference to their book to you.
Oh, absolutely! Please send to my BBS things a link.
Right. Oh, well, I will do that. Okay.
She can do it, because I had actually Sonia here also, so that was very nice.
Oh, right.
So I think Sonia is your publisher.
That's right.
See, the world is small.
Yes. Oh, but Sonia's not actually there now with you, is she? No.
No.
Okay. No. Do you know Sonia, do you?
I had her maybe a few weeks ago on the show.
Oh, yes. Oh, did you really? Okay.
Yes, I absolutely love her. Actually, when I saw you information, I said, oh my God, Sonia is here too. And then I realized it's actually the same company. I said, that's okay. Listen, good. we still have 3 minutes. Okay, what I would like to finish with it is, beam me up, Scotty.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one of my articles. Yes, all right.
Give us 3 minutes.
3 minutes. The 3 minutes is essentially, beam me up. If my theories are correct, beam me up, Scotty, is where we're headed. In the future, it will be possible to travel via wormholes. the reason for this is essentially my theories are the networked intelligence in the DNA. The actual complete physical theory for it is that the valence electrons in my DNA and the valence electrons in your DNA are what's known as entangled. Excuse me. This word entanglement is a buzzword in quantum computing, and it means that when two electrons are entangled, it means that information can pass between them at infinite speeds, at speeds faster than the speed of light. In other words...
Listen, I experienced that. I am familiar with that.
Okay. So essentially, then the way the theory goes, that this so-called entanglement is actually caused by these wormholes. I've read articles in New Scientist that for instance, black holes are supposed to be entangled, and the reason why they're entangled is that there are wormholes existing between these black holes. So the beam me up, Scotty, aspect of it then is essentially that once we get better, more technological savvy about the quantum processing, at some stage it's going to be possible actually to travel via wormholes. And as a matter of fact,
Bradley, do you think that CERN is one of the indication?
That the what?
CERN, what? Sorry, is CERN in Switzerland is one of the
available. Oh, no, okay.
No?
No. No, okay. they're just all about just crashing particles together and trying to analyze from the fallout potential particles there. No, CERN has got nothing to do with this notion of wormholes, but because the essential message with beam me up, Scotty, is quantum computing has already proved that this entanglement exists. Quantum computing has already proved that it is possible for light and signals to travel at infinite speeds, faster than the speed of light. And so quantum computing has already proved that wormholes do exist. And so it's only a matter of now of with advanced knowledge, where we will develop the technology actually to travel ourselves via wormholes. And as a matter of fact, I've actually put together a movie script based on this these notions of wormhole travel and whatnot, based on my theories in the book. And Sonia is she's a producer, movie producer. She's just produced her own a documentary, Business of Disease. And
yes,
right now she's out there trying to sell this movie script then that I've put together to see if we can get make a movie about this, precisely on this notion of what's going to happen with the beam me up Scotty scenarios.
That is so awesome. Listen, I would love to be updated on that.
Yes. Okay, well, you can just ask Sonia about all that, because
perfect.
She's working on that right now.
Oh, that is so amazing, actually. Well, see, that's a perfect closing, actually. Well, listen,
oh, yes.
Bradley. Listen, I'm so excited. That was a pretty amazing information. And you know what? I just wanted to let you know that maybe down in the future, I would love to have you back, because there's so much more that we can talk about.
Okay, sure. We'll just contact Sonia anytime.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'll be only too happy. I enjoyed this. I've enjoyed our talk very much, Magdalena.
Oh, perfect. Listen, I am so happy that we had finally, you know, we made it, you know, through all these challenges. And thank you so much. And I wish you, you know, good health and, you know, enjoy Australia. And I really had a good time with talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Magdalena. Well, I'll speak to you again in the future.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Okay, then.
Good night.
Good night.
Good
Bye-bye.
Night, everybody. Thank you so much. And until the next show, have a good one. Thank you.